driving you home every weekday afternoon. This is 105 Drive with Julian Clover.
The new rugby season is due to start in September. Shelford Rugby Club was founded in 1933 and is one of the area's leading clubs. Phil Rowe caught up with Rory Finlayson at an event in Great Shelford. He's director of youth rugby for the club. Not only that, he's also the assistant coach and youth fixtures secretary.
A little lull in the music at the moment. There's just behind us now one of the lovely jazz bands on a 40-foot trailer, which is getting ready to perform to us. I'm just going to get out of the way of some shuttlecocks as well, the nearby stall, so we don't get treated too much as targets. But in the meantime, on the stall next to them is Rory Finlayson. He's the head of youth at the Shelford Rugby Club. You're looking forward to next season, I guess, Rory, already?
Yes, we've already started pre-season for the seniors, and the youth will start their season when the first Sunday in September comes around.
You're head of youth training for the club?
Well, I head up the youth, so I'm the director of youth rugby for my sins.
So, for your sins. Taking them from what ages? Because, of course, it's boys and girls, isn't it?
It is. We take them from under seven, but that's the catch-all age group, so there'll be 5- and 6-year-olds in the under seven group. So, whenever the parents feel that they are ready to do team sport, then we're ready to take them.
You're based down on Davyfield, off Cambridge Road in Great Shelford, not far away from where we are this afternoon. You've also got a little activity for everybody. What's going on behind me here? I can see rugby balls in the net.
We've set up a rugby obstacle course to try and show people, highlight the game really, and try and let them know that the rugby club is an integral part of the village.
And they're going to try and pace their way through those rope ladders, I guess.
That's right. Well, it's quick feet for the ladders, so they normally trip over those. Then it's through the poles, which they normally knock over, then up and collect a rugby ball off of the tackle bag, round the top pole, and then it's a sprint back and a slide on the water slide to the end.
And rain will never stop play when it comes to rugby.
No, the muddier the better, I think.
It's not too muddy just where we are this afternoon, down at the entrance there, where obviously there's a lot of footfall. It's got a little bit muddy around the main marquee. You've also been in the Grand Arena this afternoon.
We have. We've been highlighting both spectrums of the rugby club. So that's the under-8s, which is tag rugby. And then we've had under-16s who have done a demonstration of the top end of the youth. And the seniors will be on later on, we hope.
Started training for the new season yet with the youth teams? Presumably they have their own tournaments as well as the adults.
They do. The youth season doesn't start until September. Some of them will have started pre-season, but that's just the older age group. It's really just the senior sides, which is 17, 18 upwards, who have started.
And there's obviously the summer holidays upon us for the children. Any parents that might be listening to this, how if they think their child is particularly interested in rugby, the next prodigy maybe, and they want to join the youth side or the youth club or get some training from you, Rory, or from Shelford Rugby Club, where should they apply?
Well, if they want to start playing rugby, they contact myself, and my details are all on the Shelford website. I'll inform them of which age group they'll fall into, where they need to turn up, what kit they need, and we'll go from there.
Rory, you look extremely wet, actually, more than most of us. I guess you were pitching out. It started raining really badly at about 20 to 12, just as everyone was trying to get the gazebo up. Were you out in that?
Unfortunately, I was, but rugby, it's warm, and you know, rain doesn't stop play for rugby, so I was quite pleased to see it, really.
That's the attitude, and it never changes. Rory, thanks very much.
The club is now a National League side. Pre-season friendlies are being played, and this Saturday, ahead of the season, the Shelford First 15 is at home to the Peterborough Lions at the Davyfield Ground at 3 p.m. That's on Cambridge Road in Great Shelford. Phil Vogt reporting there.
This is the chart you've been voting for. The Unsigned Chart on 105 Drive. The top 5 records from Cambridge's hottest musicians, as voted for by you.
So here we are, as always, on a Thursday night, starting off our entertainment hour with a look at the unsigned chart. The chart comprises of local artists from in and around Cambridge. They haven't got a record deal, and they've been put up for the vote in the weekly chart that you can vote for at Cambridge105.fm. We'll start, as we always do, with the new entry for this week. It comes from John Chisholm, and it's Made for This.
One, two, three, four.
New entry in the unsigned chart this week, John Chisholm, the song Made for This.
Yeah, that kind of funny feeling inside.
Emma Stillhill, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I like it.
That's not so bad, is it?
Chippy.
Yeah, enjoyed that. John is 17 years of age, he's from Cambridge. It's a new track from his soon-to-be-released second EP. He counts his influences as Mumford & Sons, Frank Turner, good choice, The Wombats, Ben Howard and Ed Sheeran. And the track, if you're interested, can be downloaded for free via SoundCloud.
The top five records from Cambridge's hottest musicians, as voted for by you.
So let's count down the chart, the unsigned chart for week 121. Out goes Alicia Catling, who didn't even vote for herself. So Alicia, silly girl, deserved to go out for that. Number five, Fred's House, Bonnie and Clyde. Number four, Young Son, So Long. So Slow, So Long, Subtle. Number three, Tom Lumley, Every Day. That's a bit of a long runner, heading towards the 20 weeks there, I think. Number two, Cody Pennington, About Love, which means at number one, it's Screen People, All Seeing Eyes.
The Unsigned Chart.
you have at this, but if it works, you will be missed. You'll be reborn again. But the darkness from your seeing eyes consumes the endless hate and lies of goodness, will and love. This, but if it works, it will be bliss. Babe, one, I'll give you that.
Number one in the Unsigned chart this week, All Seeing Eyes from Screen People, which I think has been number one for what could be heading for the most weeks that a song has been consecutively at number one. Normally, they even the long runners tend to slide around a bit, so maybe they'll do that. You can help them do so, if you wish. And you need to go to cambridge105.fm/unsigned chart. And Tim will unveil the new chart next Wednesday night at 8 o'clock as part of the New Music Generator programme. Before that, on Monday night, if you tune in just after six, we'll give you the details on the unsigned chart as it stands. It's 12 minutes past six, Cambridge 105, our regular entertainment hour, but a little bit different this week in the absence of Skye and Hattie. They did tell me what they were doing and I've completely forgotten, but we've got Toby Miller here, which is good. Hello, Toby.
Hello.
For those who don't know, Toby is normally the host of Cambridge 105's Bums on Seats, and two reasons you're here. First of all, you're going to look at a couple of movies, which are...
What If and Sin City 2 are the two I sort of picked out of the rabble that's currently at the multiplex, neither of which I've seen, which is unusual for me.
Okay. I was actually rather taken by a Thomas the Tank Engine movie, which...
There's a new one? Or is
I'm
it just
not
a
sure. This is quite an interesting one. It's running at Vue, and it was described as an exclusive, which I think is probably a euphemism for normally straight to video.
It's not possible.
It tends to happen at the children's end of the market sometimes.
Well, they release about 14 new children's films a week.
Mm. So. Children's market is very interesting in terms, I think, of certainly when VHS was going out of the way. It was kind of like the last genre which was still selling on VHS, presumably because the old units had migrated to the kid's bedroom or something like that anyway. But more importantly, after we've done the current movies, we're going to be having an overview of the Cambridge Film Festival, which starts today, doesn't it?
It has started. I've left there to come here.
But what am I keeping you for? What have you pulled out of?
Probably just writing. It's a Saturday show.
Yeah,
sitting in the bar writing. I haven't got. I had one film planned for today, but I've already decided I'd better pull it so I can concentrate on editing some audio.
I feel like asking what you're going to reject. That'd be a bit mean, really. Okay, Toby, we'll hear from you in a moment or two. First, here's the current one from David Guetta. What is it with all these songs with false endings? I don't know. 17 minutes past 6 o'clock, the entertainment hour on 105 Drive. And tonight we are in the company of Toby Miller, the grandee of Bums on Seats.
Yes, thank you.
That's all right. See, you don't normally get an introduction like that on a Saturday morning.
No, but I should push my reviewers to be a little bit... They're quite sort of... a bit more like that off air, actually, which is kind of embarrassing. I get called boss a lot.
Which, they're tugging their forelocks and that sort of stuff.
I haven't requested, and it just seems to come naturally to people talking to me, I guess.
Yeah, look on the bright side, they're not calling you gaffer. Okay, so we're looking at a couple of movies, first of all. What's the first one?
It's sort of the dregs of the summer now, which is unfair, perhaps, on one of these films. The first one we're going to go with is What If?, which used to be called, in production, it was called the F word, which stood for friend in this case, but they were afraid that not many people would get the pun. It's sort of where when Harry met Sally for the Y generation, and it's
got a Harry in it, hasn't it, of sorts?
It is. The poor man cannot leave this role behind, no matter how he tries. Yes, it's Daniel Radcliffe playing a romantic lead, which seems a very conventional thing to do. And I'm sure he's been offered a lot of those, but he's taken some fairly obscure roles. He's got a horror film coming up called Horns. He was in Kill Your Darlings earlier this year, which was the Beat Generation. He played, not Kerouac, he played one of the Beat Poets. And so he's tried hard to escape the shadow of Harry Potter. This might actually be rather an ingenious move to play I'm not sure he's that cynical about it, not that planned, but to play a sort of romantic lead, a sort of Cary Grant figure, in what is, by all accounts, a particularly conventional, predictable romantic comedy with a wittier than usual script. There's a sort of delight in predictability. It's a sort of a comfort in predictability. Sometimes it can be charming, and by all accounts, again, this an rare. I see everything for Bums on Seats, but in this case, I've been so full of festival, I've not been able to see this. By all accounts, it does work.
Okay,
I believe you have a clip.
We do indeed.
I'm just gonna go because I don't want to wreck your dinner party.
No, it's not a dinner party. It's just like my friend Wallace.
Stay. This Wallace guy could be a good rebound for you.
Okay. Please go easy on him. He's delicate.
Hey.
Thank you. That's so nice.
You're welcome.
You can take your coat off.
I will. Thank you very much. No, this place is just like I imagined.
Really?
Well, I mean, yeah, I picture more potpourri and doilies and stuffed animals and things.
Yeah.
Knowing you,
but, put all that stuff away. I know that it weirds you out. Ben, Wallace is here.
How are you?
Hi.
No. Sorry.
No worries.
Thanks for coming by.
No, nice to meet you, man. Thank you.
Hey, Eddie.
Hey.
Oh, Wallace is my sister, Dahlia.
Nice to
meet you.
Oh.
Hi.
Hello.
You smell really good.
Really?
Yeah, or I don't know, maybe it just smells really bad in here.
No, it smells great, but it is getting kind of oniony in here. Can someone open the window?
Yeah, I'll get it.
I'm not sure about that accent. It's kind of it's like contemporary Dick Van Dyke English, really, isn't it?
I will not have a word said against Dick Van Dyke. He's a genius. I don't know what nationality he's playing. I just presumed he was playing British.
It's sort of British, but it's one of those sort of if you ask a Brit to do a Cockney accent, the Americans wouldn't probably understand it. So you then have to soften it up a bit.
It's movie Cockney.
Yeah. It's the kind of accent that I don't think people actually have in real life.
Maybe eventually movies will just sort of seep so much into popular consciousness that that accent will come to exist.
I think it possibly
like
will, actually. The text speak, in the way that Neighbours did all that stuff to the English language when it first launched.
The upward inflection.
Precisely.
Yes. Daniel Radcliffe plays a character called Wallace, who was a year out of a relationship that broke his heart. He has a sort of meet cute with Zoe Kazan's character Chantry, but she has a long term boyfriend. So they're friends, and it's that story of can they be more than friends, and is that wise? It's unusual again by all accounts, in that we get a lot of these films, and we don't tend to review them on Bums on Seats because they're very poor. There's nothing finer in movies than a well written romantic comedy. But they don't tend, at the moment, to be particularly well-written, and they can be a bit ten a penny. This one is more like a John Hughes film from the 1980s. It has that sort of wit to it. And it follows the male protagonist more than the female protagonist. The romantic comedies tend to be just marketed to a rather reductive view of the female audience that the money men think they've got. And they don't try any more than that. This has been... it's based on a play called Toothpaste and Cigars, which suggests it only moves around two or three rooms on stage. And
it's funny, that clip, which we heard the audio from, does have that kind of play look about it. Not all films do that when they've been taken from a play, I've found, but that one certainly does.
It's got a lot of very talkative actors and sort of young hip things, not just Daniel Radcliffe, but Zoe Kazan is spoken of as an up and coming starlet. She's sort of Hollywood royalty in a way.
What else has she been in?
It's not what she's been in. She's the granddaughter of Kazan, the famous film director. Eli Kazan. And Adam Driver, who's from Girls and very many other things in little bits and pieces. He was in Francis Ha last year. He's the villain in the next Star Wars film. He plays the best friend in it. And Rafe Spall, who's this generation's Ralph Meeker in terms of disappointed in love. He plays the long-term boyfriend who presumably, if this goes the way these things go, it doesn't work out with. But I don't know. But I think it's fair to the characters, where most of these would set up somebody for a fall and then caricature them so the audience is willing to fall. I think this film is fairer on the characters. And from what I've read, Daniel Radcliffe, who's a fine actor, he's fine in what he's given with the Harry Potters. Harry Potter's not particularly a three-dimensional character as such. Not much to chew on there. He's fine, and so I'm pleased if he makes it as a romantic lead. It would be nice, but I'm sure he won't stay there. I'm sure he'll try something more challenging.
He does seem to sort of move around a bit, and I forget what's the name of the play he did in the West End for quite a while.
He was in Equus
for a while. That's the one I was trying to think of.
I think he was in Guys and Dolls for a while as well.
Yeah, he was in something else. I can't remember what the something else was, though, but he's certainly trying to at least tell everybody that he can do other roles, and that's
it's difficult
for any child actor, I guess.
Yes, and he's not quite leading man stock. He's not a particularly tall man. Not that many movie stars are particularly gigantic. Hollywood's a tiny, tiny place. I think he's more might make it more as a character actor. I don't mind. He's fine in the Harry Potter films, and everybody deserves to make it on their own terms rather than be constantly referred to by one thing that they did as a critical shorthand. That's very unfair on actors.
Okay, so that's in all good cinemas now, then. It's a particular
it's a certificate 15.
Right.
So it's like most films, actually. Most films are certificate 15. So.
Okay, we'll do some more in just a moment. Right, so we're chatting with Toby Miller about movies. Also coming up, a preview of the film festival. But first of all, going to turn our attention to Sin City 2.
The sequel nobody thought would happen. The first Sin City, which is sort of on regular rotation.
Ages ago.
2005. But yes, ages ago. Funny how time, we measure time now. It's on regular rotation on ITV4 or BBC3 or something. But it took them ages to get the money to throw it together. And the way the director Robert Rodriguez makes this in his other films, like Spy Kids or Machete or whatever it is, they have huge casts of actors not taking anything particularly seriously, but he can film them piecemeal and patchwork it together. Everybody's filmed against a green screen pretty much, certainly for the Sin City series, because he's after a look that mimics as closely as possible the original Frank Miller's original graphic novels. So he could film Bruce Willis on Tuesday and then film Jessica Alba on Thursday when her schedule allows, and then sandwich the two together and with a few props. And
You almost expect to see bubbles coming out of their mouth, really, at any moment.
Yes, it's. I'm sort of betwixt and between. I'm not a huge fan of Robert Rodriguez. I feel like he's sort of an example of the man-child idea of in modern cinema, that where women are just objects. I know the film sort of comments on these things, but it doesn't comment sharply enough to get away with what it's doing. All the women in it are always in their underwear. They're always either playing prostitutes or bad women or something. But again, on the other side, to be positive, there are some truly abstract visuals in these films, which I'm amazed you can only get away with this approach. There are shots in Sin City 2, certainly, in the scenes I've seen, and the first Sin City, that if they were away from the green screen, you couldn't do, and two, the audience might not be so ready to accept. You've given it a frame that allows you to get away with much more in terms of almost genuine surrealism in terms of framing. I have a problem with it, but I sort of respect that he's trying to do that, and I respect that he does it on his own time, and he makes these things for a fairly minimal budget.
And it's sort of black and white. I say sort of, because...
Blood is yellow,
yes,
or something.
And there's sort of colours sort of splashes across the screen from time to time.
And this new one's in 3D. The first one obviously wasn't, but Rodriguez has been shooting in 3D for a while now. So that can only enhance the sort of layered... picture book quality of it. I think everybody seems to be suggesting, and this isn't a surprise, that you go see it. If you go see it, you only go really go see it for Eva Green, who is an astonishing French actress who was Vespa Lind in Quantum of Solace, and she was in Bertolucci's Dreamers, and she was in Tim Burton's Dark Shadows. She seems possessed of a sort of clockwork eroticism that sort of not many actresses are capable of, and she was in the sequel to 300, another belated sequel earlier this year, and which I've not seen, but again, apparently she was easily the best thing in it. The sort of ferocious energy she brings to a lot of roles. She's not afraid of being undressed, which, if you can, a Robert Rodriguez film seems to be.
Par for the course. He took some of his Spy Kids actress and undressed her for Machete, for example.
Yes, and she's also in Sin City 2, A Dame to Kill For. The Dame to Kill For is Eva Green's character, Ava Lord, and it's got several plots, like the first film, like the first Sin City. It's based on numerous of Frank Miller's stories, most of them from the second book. I think a couple or one of them's from the sixth book, and they intermingle, and it's not linear with the first film. Josh Brolin plays Dwight in this film. This predates... Dwight's the character Clive Owen plays in the first film.
Okay,
yeah. In the books, Dwight has plastic surgery, which, in the film world, moves him from being Josh Brolin to Clive Owen. So the Dwight character in this predates the Dwight character in...
Okay,
in
I think I've got that. We've got a clip, so we'll have a listen to that.
Oh, I completely forgot, of course.
That's
the visuals will come across frontally.
The trick, then, for this, then, is while the clip's playing, just look up at the ceiling.
You're going to suck me dry, and you'll never, ever stop!
No, please, no!
Nobody's killing anybody. Not while I'm around.
There we go.
So, yeah, but you can pretty much imagine what that will look like.
It's pretty much cartoon dialogue. It's basically somebody coming through the ceiling, lots of fist fights, and a girl on a chaise lounge.
I don't mind any of those things. All of those things are vital ingredients for cinema. But and there are many genres based around exactly that. I just feel that it just annoys me because there is acres and acres and acres of film noir from the 40s onwards and the 30s and the 40s onwards, which are stunningly written, brilliant films. And I just feel like this is the crayon version of those.
I was going to say, does it do it badly, or does it just do it average?
It misunderstands it. It takes the most basic elements from film noir, that the femme fatale. It regresses them further. So it addresses them. It does all that. It's taken what it thinks are the salient points of film noir, the violence, the sort of amoral code of the characters, and the femme fatale, and turns all of those up, like Spinal Tap, up to 11, and doesn't give you anything else. And it's good, but it's a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of something superior, and anything that's vaguely approaching... meat. It's like hamburgers. Everything that's been approaching real food has been taken out, and it's. I'm getting lost in analogies here.
The edges have been smoothed, I guess.
There's something I find vaguely offensive about it, and I think it's because I know that I'm suspicious of the audience. It's really, really aimed at the people who's swallow this stuff whole. And
is that the comic book audience, the kind of people who would be turning up to CamCon, that sort of thing?
Oh, certainly not the majority of them, because there is as many women as there are men. I think most of them will take all of this with a pinch of salt, and I don't think that's good. That's enough of an excuse most of the time, but there'll be one or two that take this stuff too seriously, and that I think Rodriguez, you can play with that, and I don't think Rodriguez is smart enough to play with that. So I think that's what bugs me about these films.
Okay. Well, thank you for being for our film reviewer for this. That's fine. It's been a slice. But you're staying around because we're going to be talking about the 34th Cambridge Film Festival. That's quite a long time.
Third oldest film festival in the country after London and Edinburgh, I believe.
I was going to ask whether you might be the second oldest in the country according to what happens in a couple of weeks' time. You never know. Might lose Edinburgh. Fitz and the Tantrums, Breaking the Chains of Love, which we played for Maria, who is moaning that we hadn't had any Fitz and the Tantrums on the programme lately, says that they are currently touring in the US. I have a feeling that they actually played a gig at the US Open Tennis, which got underway on Monday. I quite like the idea, much better than the sort of thing we normally get at Wimbledon. Anyway, it's 14 minutes away from 7 o'clock, and Toby Miller is here, a talking film, and specifically the 34th Cambridge Film Festival, which has got underway this evening.
It's not officially started. I think the opening it will do in 10 minutes.
Undercard, is it to start off with?
I think the opening film is at 7, but there have been a couple of screenings prior to that. I think started at 4, basically.
I guess it's kind of the nature of having so much to fit in, really, isn't it, with a festival like that?
They tried to do a little bit less this year and have more repeat screenings, but there are still over 100 feature films screening over the next 10 and a bit days, and over 30 short films. There's 17 films alone in the Family Film Festival, which is sort of a mini film festival within the film festival.
And this is predominantly the Picture House, isn't it, where all this is
predominantly
taking place?
Previous years have also had some things at Cineworld, but the current situation of the Competition Commission means that they it's not wise to do that.
We're expecting an announcement, I think, by the end of September. It was said financials.
It keeps getting pushed back. They have made a decision, but I don't know why they're delaying announcing it. I can't say. I think it's because there's some manoeuvring going on in the background that's rather extraordinary, but it doesn't really affect what happens with the arts. But the decision has been made, and people have been found to take over whatever they take over.
No doubt we'll discover in the fullness of time. The attendances for the various screenings, are they playing to packed houses?
The bigger films are. I think that's the reason why I'm here. It's you cry at the populist film like Sin City 2 and then say, come to this little Scandinavian film about potholers. It's not like that. Some of it is, actually. Some of it is like that. Some of it will be films that will have very limited interest.
But things like Scandinavian dramas, one thinks of things like The Killing or Borgen that run on BBC Four, get, within a BBC Four context, get a pretty good audience. So
they do.
Presumably
there'd
be an audience for that sort of thing.
They've always been there. The trick is that 60%, 70% of the films that are screening at the festival, you would think, at a casual look at the programme, which is quite a thick booklet every year, they haven't worked out how quite to make it more less threatening. I'm not interested in a season of German films, or I'm not interested in a season of Catalan cinema. I don't know anything about Catalan cinema. These aren't the art films from Catalan. These aren't the art films from Germany. These are their mainstream films to an extent.
The popular films of that country
thrillers, their dramas,
the Richard Curtis equivalents, maybe at
in
times.
In some cases, there's a film in the Catalan season called Tasting Menu, which has got rave reviews, and the Picture House is putting on Catalan food on that particular day, and to go alongside it, and it's a film that if Richard Curtis is mentioned in the blurb, but it's a film that if it came out in the UK or if it was an American film with exactly nothing had changed with it, it would be embraced without. It would win an audience. There's a film on today called The Woman Who Dares, which is a German film, which is about a lady who's a 50-year-old lady who swims the Channel. Again, it's a heartwarming, slightly complex. It's not a rom-com, but it's an uplifting drama for anybody who's willing to put up with subtitles. The majority of the films have that. They have something that if you are brave, and that's really what I'm here to stress, if you're brave enough to, not brave, that's a patronizing thing to say, if you're curious enough, look through the programme in detail and think, well, actually, that sounds really interesting.
So what we're saying here, there are films by the sounds of things for the film buffs, but there are plenty of stuff, plenty of material for people who just like to go and watch good cinema.
But want to see something that they wouldn't normally see, but it wouldn't be something they wouldn't that would alienate them. There's a documentary called Love is All, 100 Years of Courtship, which is takes footage from 100 years of the BFI archive, the British Film Institute archive, and other British archives. It's a soundtrack to Richard Hawley. There's no narration, which is just how courtship and everything about romance, bar weddings, apparently, has been depicted in home movies and village fates that have been filmed and television and everything that's been in this archive. It's a fantastic, fascinating, wonderfully romantic film, but it's going to be pushed there as a little documentary, and I guarantee that almost just about everybody who goes to see a film like that will leave going, wow, that's fantastic.
And you mentioned the Catalan films. Are there some certain strands and themes that are running through the festival this year?
There's always a German theme. There's always a German cinema. You don't get to see much German cinema in UK cinema, even in the art cinemas. And remember, art cinemas and the Arts Picture House stands a little bit outside the Picture House chain to be an art cinema. It shows different things than the Arts Picture House and Stratford-upon-Avon, for instance.
I think I went to the Picture House and saw, I'm trying to remember the name of the movie. It was a German film. It was about the Baader-Meinhof gang. And yes. I think it had more blood in it than Sin City 2.
Yes, and it wouldn't have been yellow. They don't get a wide. We don't for all the art cinemas we have. They don't actually show a huge variety of stuff. Distribution is difficult. So this is the one chance. This isn't a film festival like London, or Edinburgh, or Venice. Or it's not of that scale. It's not of that importance. But equally, it's not somewhere where critics, and it's primarily critics, flock to see all the big releases for the next 10 months, and tick off the reviews that they can release later in the year. That's part of the function those festivals serve. They're distribution hubs. They're part of the marketing. They're building word of mouth. They're vital. That's what Cannes does. Cannes is a marketplace. It's something you would go down to see at Excel in London. It's that sort of thing. Cambridge isn't like that. Deals aren't struck at Cambridge. You get a chance to see films that you wouldn't see elsewhere, and you may not see again. Some of them, the new Woody Allen, which opens today at the festival, Night Moves, which also opens today at the festival, they'll have a general release. Most Wanted Man, which is a new John le Carré spy thriller starring Philip Seymour Hoffman, which is premiering at the UK premiering at the festival, I believe, that will have a run later in the year. But the Catalan cinema, all of which is approachable, some of which is thrillers, which are as good as the Nordic television on BBC Four that nobody knew about until BBC Four decided to show it, and suddenly it was wow, this is fantastic. It's
and having sat on the shelf for the BBC for 9 months before they did so, I think, as well.
Exactly. There's always the trick is just to be a bit curious and find the next thing that you didn't know you were going to like or you were going to love, and the film festival is fantastic for that. And there's big crowd pleasers. Pride is showing later in the festival.
An opportunity to, you know, our directors and producers also turning up and having Q&As perhaps with the audience?
Before I came here, I rushed here from interviewing the director of a film called The White City, a drama, romantic drama set in Tel Aviv, which has more resonance now than it did when they filmed it. It's probably a lot more resonance
than when it was booked for the festival, I suspect, as well.
Yes. Perfectly approachable. I mean, I arranged to speak to him, but he'll be around for the Q&A tomorrow. And this is what happens at the Cambridge Picture House all the time anyway, is that filmmakers mingle in the bar. It's not a red carpet festival. It might have chosen to be if it was slightly bigger, but it really, that's not where its heart sits. And it wants, you know, you get to meet the filmmakers if you choose the ones that are there, the ones that visit. It's a small festival with important people behind it, so it gets big films.
Now, we've got coverage across the festival on Cambridge 105. There's a couple of special editions of Bums on Seats, I think this Saturday and the next at 12 noon.
Yes.
And then you're doing some little podcasts and also input into this show and also breakfast, I think.
Yes, the station, Cambridge 105, is a media partner for the festival alongside various other media partners. I suddenly was going to mention Reel Them Off.
They do their own publicity, thank you.
I didn't realise that as I was going down. That was going to be generous. But before that, we have two special bums on seats at 12 o'clock on Saturday, where there'll be reviews of films coming up rather than reviews of films that have been. So people still get, audiences, listeners still get a chance to go see these films. Interviews with directors, and we're running daily podcasts on, kindly, on your
on
drive
this show,
program.
Half past four, and I think Merlin, presumably after nine, with Merlin and Linda on 105 on breakfast.
Sometimes they'll be the same thing, sometimes they'll be different.
Yeah, that's good. Well, look forward to hearing all of those. Toby, thank you for coming in. Are you back to the picture house now?
Yes.
What are you going to say?
I'm not sure I was going to see the Woody Allen film, but I think my time would be better spent editing some audio.
Okay, thanks very much. Toby Miller from Bums on Seats. More from him tomorrow at 4:30. Here's Paloma Faith. You ask for money.